Welcome back to another Meet Kevin Report. We are on episode 116. Today we've got to cover the FOMC minutes later in the day. There'll be a lot of anxiety around, is the Federal Reserve going to hike again? Are they really concerned about core inflation? We'll be covering some different pieces on exactly that. Those FOMC minutes come out around 11 Pacific time. I will be traveling, but I will make sure to get a piece out covering those as well. As far as markets starting a little bit red here on a shortened 4-day week with the skip yesterday. Hope you had a great 4th of July. Dow, S&P both down about 46 basis points and the NASDAQ down about 55 basis points. Some say the reason for that initial decline is a slowing down in China. Although we've already kind of known about this Chinese slowdown for a while, we've been talking about it, speculating about it for a very, very long time, and here it is. But anyway, you've got Bloomberg arguing that the market is more sensitive to weak services industry data from China, raising fresh concerns for the global economy. I mean, ultimately, every economy will sort of stand on its own, but they tend to be tethered together. So when you get weak buying in China, sometimes that's weak importing in China. Sometimes that's potentially an indicator of weak selling in other countries, right? It's all connected, of course, but ultimately, I'm still a big believer that the United States economy can remain strong through some of the madness that we have and are expected to go through. You go back to the headlines today, which are, oh, too early to say how deep the recession is going to be. I still can't believe how much strength you have left in this economy. I think almost everybody expected a recession much earlier than this. It is helping drive Treasury yields down a tiny little bit, down to 3.83 on the 10-year. And then you've got oil sitting 71 on WTI. 76 on Brent. We'll see how the market plays out today. So in other news, we want to take a look at the rate monitor to see how we're doing with expectations for that hike again. Our next Fed decision is in 3 weeks from today. We're looking at that 88% chance still for July in terms of a hike, and we'll probably get that unless we get some kind of weak data. My guess is a week from today. A week from today is CPI day, and we'll be getting, I can actually go through a little preview of those numbers in just a moment here. But unless we get some sort of weak report next week on CPI, I would expect that extra hike in July, which is actually not what I initially expected. I didn't think that once the Fed paused, they would go for another hike, but at least that's what the market is pricing in, with probably just one more rate increase. Really not that big of a deal, whether we get it or not, in my opinion. Terminal rate for the Federal Reserve right now is set at 5.36, and if we take a look at the 5-year break, as of Friday, it was actually increasing a little bit. We want to see that start declining. Let's see what we got here. 5-year break, yeah, it's stable, but it's at 2.32 right now. I want you to see kind of relative over the last couple months where that has played out. So we'll throw that up on screen here. That is, here it is, the bottom right corner of the inflation expectations chart for the 5-year break even. You can see a little bit of this, I hate to almost call it an uptrend here on the right, but you could somewhat see, come on, there we go, what appears to be a bit of this uptrend on the right. And we'd like to see this actually be a downtrend. So this is another thing here that could reiterate the Federal Reserve going for another hike. Another hike-a-doodle in July as they really try to drive this break-even inflation rate down. We'll see. All right, let's take a preview here at the CPI data and catalysts we've got coming up over the next week here. I think those will be relatively useful and get a little bit of a picture into what do we actually what expectations should we have and do markets have right now. All right, let's see what we got here. Okay. Interesting. All right, fine then. All right. Well, darn thing wants me to restart it. No problem. All right, fine. That'll just take a second then, while that restarts, because it's stupid. Anyway, we'll get our expectations in just a moment. Another thing that we'll be covering today is we'll go through some potential for early signs of cooling in EPS, especially in Europe. Some folks argue that Europe is expecting more of an EPS decline than the United States, specifically because of what's going on in Ukraine. Yeah, some drama over the weekend over a potential false flag operation at a nuclear facility, power plant in the southern region of Ukraine. A lot of fear about, will this be another Nord Stream pipeline, another dam? Will this basically be another sabotage, self-sabotage by Russia? Or is that just consistently what everybody in the mainstream media argues, that, oh yeah, it's Russia shooting themselves in the foot, when the reality is it's the CIA in conjunction with Ukraine? Ultimately, who knows, but the fact that it's now a nuclear power plant and sort of reigniting visions of a Chernobyl is not exactly what you want to hear. But it's what's being talked about right now, so a lot of that drama circulating right now, unfortunately. Alright, so, that said, I think I got our numbers ready now. Okay, one moment, we will call that catalysts. Okay, here we go, 20 seconds and we'll get into these catalysts coming up, and we'll have this ready. Alright. Okay. All right, here we go. So here are the catalysts to watch for the next about week and a half, and there are some big ones, including the numbers coming out for the Consumer Price Index, which is in just a week from today. And in a week from now, we'll also start getting some of the initial earnings sets, most of the juice coming right after this upcoming week. But first, let's get into some catalysts in terms of expectations. So today we'll get some factory orders and durable good numbers. We'll also be getting the FOMC minutes. Those will be out at 2 p.m. Eastern, 11 a.m. Pacific. That'll be the big catalyst for today. We'll be looking for what does the Fed actually think in terms of this idea of a hawkish skip. Jerome Powell told us he didn't want to call it a skip, or that he shouldn't call it a skip. But what does that mean? Does it mean that you've paused? Or does it mean that there are maybe many more rate hikes to come? In his recent discussion with Sarah Eisen, he suggested that forecasters were expecting potentially as many as two or more rate hikes coming. Of course, markets seem to be relatively calm about the idea that, okay, we might get another 25 or 50 BP from the Fed, or even a little bit more, because frankly, if we look at the past year, we had 500 basis points of change in interest rates. Going forward, we've got maybe another 50 plus or minus, so 10% of what we had over the last year. It's kind of like getting spanked really hard for a year long, and now they're kind of just like, you know, softly touching us. It's not a big deal anymore. Of course, then you wonder, when is the lagging impact of those previous spankings really going to come through? Tomorrow, we will be looking for ADP employment numbers, which is exciting because it leads into Employment Friday. That's a big deal for this week. Employment numbers tomorrow are expected at 5:15 a.m. We will expect that private payrolls report. It's really a tool that we use to try to be critical of the actual official government data with, which is useful. We'll also get some job-changing payrolls numbers in terms of how much wages are rising. Remember, we do not want any indicators of a wage price spiral, and even though wages can still grow above 3% to be consistent with 2% inflation, we want to make sure those numbers aren't disanchoring, so we'll take a look at that tomorrow. We are expecting 223,000 jobs in the ADP report tomorrow. That is down from the 278,000 jobs in the prior release. So we'll go through that private payrolls report in detail. Initial jobless claims which come out tomorrow as well, are expected at 245, with continuing claims at 1.75 million, both of those roughly stable. PMI numbers tomorrow at 6:45 a.m. California time, expected at 54.1, with JOLTS job openings out tomorrow as well. A lot of catalysts coming up. It's not just those darn minutes. But the JOLTS numbers expecting to finally show some decline from 10.1 million to 9.9, although frankly that's relatively low. And even at 9.9, with about 6 million in, unemployed, we're still looking at about 1.65 job openings to unemployed individuals. It's shrinking. Jerome Powell was really hoping for this number to get closer to 1-to-1, but it's been a very, very slow trend to get job openings to actually close, mostly as businesses continue to either labor hoard or have enough profitability, which enables them to labor hoard and hopefully spend through this recession or whatever we're going to call it. As far as catalysts, I don't know when we're going to have the next coupon expiration. I can only imagine many of you are highly curious as to when that is going to be, but of course the courses are linked down below. Then we've got the two-month payrolls revision. That'll come out with jobs data on Friday. So we'll be looking at revisions as well as the job numbers. So what kind of job numbers are we expecting on Friday? Well, in the last report, we had 339,000 jobs. In this upcoming report, we're looking for 225,000. So a pretty big drop in that payrolls number, although still vastly positive. I think JP Morgan has an estimate that maybe we'll actually go negative in payrolls as soon as September. But frankly, if we get a June report at 225, it seems wild that in just basically 3 months or three more reports, July, August, and September, we'll actually be negative. But who knows? Unemployment rate is expected to drop, actually, from 3.7 to 3.6. Looking for average hourly earnings coming in at 0.3%, which is nearly consistent with the 3.6% that you would like to see. 3% would be consistent with 2% inflation. 0.3% would be consistent with 3.6 at an annualized rate of wage gains. So that would be a little hotter than that 3% you'd be looking for to get to 2% CPI, but getting closer, which is good. We really don't want to see that number disanchor. That wouldn't be great. And average hourly earnings year over year expected to be 4.2%. Labor force participation rate expected to be stable at 62.6. Then on the 10th, going into next week, we'll have wholesale inventories and trade sales data, as well as the big one, CPI. Mark your calendar if you have not yet for CPI data release on the 12th. That'll be very important. July 12th, we will have the CPI month over month expectation set right now for 0.2%, which is up from the 0.1% in the prior read. However, core month over month is expected to be down from the prior read of 0.4 to 0.3. With listen to this, now that we are comparing year-over-year inflation to the peak level that we had last year. Who here remembers? Leave a comment. Who here remembers doing CPI on the beaches of Germany? Well, it was a beach of a lake. They still have beaches. But anyway, I was doing that streaming from the beach in Germany last June, and we got the highest report I still remember ever, basically, in the last 4 years. I still remember making the thumbnail because the expectations were 8.7%. And so I made the thumbnail with a big 9% in it. And then we ended up getting like a 9.1%. It was insane. But anyway, why that's so important is we are actually a year away from that now, which means we are going to lap that number, which makes our year-over-year comparison pretty good. In fact, listen to this. Instead of a 4% like we had in the prior read, we are expecting headline CPI to be just 3.1%. That's insane, especially because if we miss that by just 0.2%, we'll be at 2.9%. And remember, Inflation expectations are trending down. We're at the lowest level in 2 years in inflation expectations for the 3 years out, as we talked about yesterday. And why does that matter? Because they can often be self-fulfilling. If people expect low inflation, what happens? They don't tend to go out and buy, and it tends to self-fulfill lower price increases and a more moderated economy. So that CPI report's going to be delicious next week, and it will be what ends up as the deciding factor for the June 22nd FOMC meeting from the Fed, which happens 2 weeks after our next CPI data. So we've got still got a little bit of a wait here for the Fed. 3 weeks from today, basically, for the Fed. 1 week from today for CPI data. On the 13th, we'll get PPI data. Then we'll start looking at some import prices and University of Michigan consumer sentiment surveys again. But probably what's going to be more entertaining is the fact that starting the week of the 14th, on Friday the 14th, we are actually starting to get bank reports in the morning. We'll be looking at JP Morgan, United Health, Citigroup, Wells Fargo, all of them reporting in the AM of Friday the 14th. And that is going to set off the ringing bell for earnings season. By the way, shout out to Gasman and 31095 for remembering that June report. And thank you, by the way, for mentioning entertaining house hack video, Kevin. I'm not so sure about the dot, dot, dot ellipse you've got there, but I'll take it. Thank you. Anyway, as far as earnings, we got a lot of them coming out. Specifically on the 18th of Tuesday, you're going to be looking at Bank of America, Schwab, Morgan Stanley, PNC, Bank of New York Mellon in the AM. Then in the afternoon on the 18th, this is close, folks. This is less than 2 weeks away. Interactive Brokers, J.B. Hunt. On that Wednesday, the 19th, in the morning, you'll have Goldman Sachs, Halliburton, U.S. Bancorp, NASDAQ, Ally Financial, First Horizon. So a lot of banking stress will be looked at. Then, of course, you'll get the juicy stuff. You ready for this? Netflix, United Airlines, IBM, Steel Dynamics. Isn't Tesla? I'm pretty sure Tesla, Roblox. Pretty sure Tesla is on the 19th. No, sorry, Roblox isn't there. Pretty sure Tesla is on the 19th as well, but I'm going to confirm that because I don't see it on this list. Anyway, AM on the 20th, you get Johnson & Johnson, Taiwan Semiconductors, D.R. Horton. We really want to see what those home builders are up to. Let me quickly get it here. Tesla earnings release, which I suppose a note is in store for the home builders. The home builders have killed it. Even as prices were falling mid to late last year, even as prices were falling for real estate, the builder stocks were doing well. And then, of course, this year so far, prices have been falling, have been rising. So real estate has not been short this year, given that prices have been rising. And potentially the catch-up play there, in my opinion, confirming July 19th. For the earnings announcement after hours. But anyway, for Tesla. But as far as the home builders, possibly the way to play catch up on the home builders, if real estate does well, if it does, solar. We'll see. But that's the left behind stepchild of the stock market rally over here. So we'll pay attention to the solar industry as well. Obviously, earnings this upcoming earnings season could be a catalyst as well, given the lack of sort of wholesale ordering that really crushed some of those Q1 numbers coming out of Q4, which is usually where you have a big solar push. So those are some of the big catalysts coming up. Obviously, regarding Tesla, not only are people going to be looking at vehicular margin, which might actually go negative for a certain, the standard model of the Model 3 in China, which is wild, which means if we get less orders in China, that could be good. Given that China has relatively started slowing down, maybe we have more US and European sales for that Model 3, which could boost margin, which would be good. Obviously, the next red flags for Tesla are going to be negative free cash flow and potential money raise. But after those delivery numbers over the weekend, there's a lot of optimism for Tesla. Tesla did end up closing up 6.9% on Monday, which is quite remarkable. And if you want to be aware of these sort of quite remarkable posts, then it's really important that you follow me on Twitter at RealMeatKevin. See, I wrote, Tesla literally closes up 6.9%. You can't make this stuff up. And there's a screenshot of it. And then sure enough, within 2 minutes of me posting that, out of nowhere comes Elon Musk liking the tweet. So, anywho, that's where you've got your calendar shaping up. I would say by far the biggest catalyst out of all of this is going to be the CPI read, obviously. The CPI read's a big deal. It's going to dictate exactly what ends up happening with the Fed. Are we going to get another hike or not? If we get a miss here, I'm very excited. I would love to see a miss. I am nervous that there's a chance we could end up getting a beat, as in like a higher number, although sometimes people call like a lower number a beat. But anyway, there is a risk of a higher core thanks to travel, specifically that air travel, the hotels, the lodging. People have just been spending, I think, more than the seasonal adjustment is going to consider. So there is that risk. But you know what? It ain't fun if there's no risk. Mm-hmm. All right. So that does it for Catalyst. Oh, boy, that is not a good coffee. Anyway. All right. And that does it for Catalyst. Thanks for watching the Catalyst segment. All right. Let's take a peek over here. What do we got talking about? Threads over here? That's boring.
These things can exist that will really work as a town square. If you have
a network effect makes it.
Right, the network effect makes it work. That if Facebook is successful, the question is, it would have to be super successful because you basically have to rip everybody off of Twitter, everybody off of Truth Social, everybody off of all these things to be in one place to work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then we're going to see how that plays out. The network effect means that if you're like birds flocking to a telephone wire, you want to be where everybody else is tweeting. I think that he's now going to be pressured, and so is Linda Yaccarino, to say, okay, let's make sure this is a comfortable place so people don't fly to the other wire.
So we've got Elon Musk involved in so many businesses, running them, got his finger on the pulse of so many. How is he dividing his time? You've spent time with him. How much time is he spending on
Twitter? It's totally amazing because I have spent hours and hours per day with him. And he can serially focus. Even the moment where his Twitter bid is accepted, he's down in Boca Chica, Texas, where they launched Starship, the rocket, looking at the Raptor engines and doing a two-hour meeting on how to simplify the sort of heat shields underneath those 33 Raptors on it. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, you just got Twitter. How can your mind not be jumping around? But it's that... Is that focus? And he's just starting an AI company now, XAI, because he's worried about what OpenAI and what DeepMind Google are doing. So
he's
running
them all. If you're a Tesla shareholder, you're not worried about the time that he's spending on Twitter and
I think I would definitely have been worried. I do think it's good that Linda Yaccarino is now focusing on a lot of the aspects of Twitter, but the rocket ships keep going up. They keep getting to orbit. Tesla just set a record on quarterly sales. So every time I get worried, I think, well, maybe I was wrong.
Before we let you go, when we came back from commercial, Courtney read a headline about what's happening with China, the Biden administration, and cloud computing. It seems to be the next step in what we're doing around talking about AI and what kind of chips we're allowing them to have. How far do you think this goes? Do you think it changes?
Well, I think we've gone a little bit too far in getting adversarial to China. We have to be very specific of what we care about, and that's national security things. So on some of the chips, some of the technology, you definitely don't want those to be exported. Right. You have to find that germanium and other raw materials China's not going to give to us. But I think what you're seeing Secretary Blinken and others doing is cooling down the rhetoric, going there, Secretary Yellen going there. And I do hope that we don't try to decouple our economy from China or confront China. We have to learn how to treat them as adversaries, in some cases partners in others. And one of the things that happened on Blinken's trip to China is he brought up AI as a possible area where they should be joint cooperation. And the Chinese leaped at that. They said, yes, let's work on that. And all the way from Kissinger to the president on diplomacy, you'll always find certain tracks that you want to talk about.
Yeah. So I guess we're going to go. So I can't ask you about CNN then.
Well, you can ask. But so, I just don't want to. I mean, I'm not. I was there 20 years ago.
I know when you were there, but you just saw what happened. You know, Malone said hire some journalists, get back to trying to be somewhat in the center. And so many dead enders are still there that Chris Licht basically didn't have a chance from the very beginning. So what does Zaslav do now? What would you do at CNN? Would you just admit what you are and stay left and as an alternative to Fox? Or would you actually try to bring it back to the CNN that you ran?
Joe, I ran it 20 years ago. I think I'm the only person
who ran it like it was. Would you have run it like Zucker ran it?
Look, every person's got to come along to the times they do. I do think there's a hunger. I'm going to say this generally to answer your question. There's a hunger now for really valuable information in the era of AI, in the era of social media, right, in the area of judges in Louisiana telling social media companies what they couldn't do. You say this is really trusted information, and you license that information to AI companies who don't want their chatbots to hallucinate but want them to get things right. I think there's a lane right now of producing highly reported, highly valuable information.
Walter Isaacson, thank you, sir. Nice to see you.
So you're not coming back.
Appreciate it.
You're not going back.
All right. So over the weekend, actually not over the weekend, I don't know why it feels like today's a weekend or like a Monday back from the weekend. It feels a little broken. maybe it's just me. Anyway, we had a ruling on July 4th. The July 4th ruling was pretty damning for the government. And I'd like to go through some of the details of it because it's quite frankly remarkable. So I have it here, and I think you'd find very interesting some of the pieces of it. So let me get you started here. Yesterday was July 4th, and a ruling came out that was mind-blowing. I'm going to show you exactly what happened in that ruling and some of the juiciest pieces of this, which are really mind-blowing and shocking. But let's get started with my tweet. Remember to follow me at RealMeatKevin on Twitter. I tweeted, a U.S. federal judge just ordered the government to stop acting like George Orwell's Ministry of Truth. Yes, this judge literally called the government the Ministry of Truth in their ruling, suggesting the government is suppressing free speech on social media, especially regarding views that the government disagrees with. In the ruling, we get a quote, free speech is not a political party. Of course, I question, why isn't this already illegal? But it's not. In fact, the censorship from our existing government is quite frankly pervasive, and some of this even more scary than some of the stuff we've seen in the Twitter files. I'd like to show you some examples. I'm going to start with some basic highlights, then I'm going to get into some summaries, so that way we don't have to go through all 155 pages together. But just to give you an example, basically, if the allegations in this ruling are true, which you're going to see some real examples here, and I think we can all say, yeah, they're pretty much true. We'll see, though. You got to give everyone the benefit of the doubt. Then the judge argues, the present case arguably involves the most massive attack against free speech in the history of the United States. In fact, quote, in their attempts to suppress alleged disinformation, the federal government, and particularly the defendants, which would be like the Biden administration, the FBI, and otherwise, are alleged to have blatantly ignored the First Amendment's right to free speech. This is where they argue the right to free speech is not a member of a political party or political ideology. And there's some great quotes here, such as, if men are to be precluded from offering their sentiments on a matter, which may involve the most serious and alarming consequences that can invite the consideration of mankind, reason then is of no use to us. Freedom of speech may be taken away, and dumb and silent we may be led like sheep to the slaughter. This is a good old founding fathers quote here, basically saying, look, if people can't share their opinions, you may as well just walk to the slaughter, because only reason and free inquiry are effectual against error. Yet another great quote. So what do we have here? Well, we have basically censorship into the following 9 allegations. Hunter Biden laptop story before the presidential election, the suppressing of the lab leak theory of COVID origins, the suppressing of the speech on the efficacy of masks, the efficacy of vaccines, election integrity, vote by mail, parody account censorship, suppressing posts that are negative about the U.S. economy, especially about gas prices, and negative posts about Joe Biden. And so there are multiple examples that they go through. I don't end up highlighting all of the examples because there are just so many of them. But I want to go through some of them just so you could get a taste for it, especially regarding how Tucker Carlson ends up getting hit here. But take a look, for example, here. So you've got this guy, Rob Flaherty, a former deputy assistant to the president and director of digital strategy. And this is kind of how things would end up going. So the director shows up and he sees some COVID vaccine tweets that he doesn't like, specifically from somebody like, oh, look at this, somebody running for president now, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. So this guy, Rob, ends up sending an email over to Twitter, and the email read, "Hey folks, wanted to flag the below tweet and wondering if we could get moving on the process of having it removed ASAP." In other words, straight up censoring somebody who has been a vaccine skeptic, Robert F. Kennedy. And many of these, you know, conspiracy theories have ended up coming out to have quite good merit. Not all of them, obviously, but some of them. And then, of course, we get arguments like this. "Cannot stress the degree to which it needs to be resolved immediately. And please remove the account immediately." Referring folks to a parody account making fun of Hunter Biden's daughter and granddaughter. A parody account needing to be removed immediately, according to the White House. Apparently, Twitter was getting so many requests and bombardments of censorship requests, they ended up creating a Twitter partner support portal specifically for the White House to have a streamlined process to censor Americans. Scary. Facebook stated it will have content distribution reduced with warning labels added where the White House wanted, and Mr. Rob over here wanted, vaccine skeptical content basically not promoted as much. So even though vaccine skeptical content did not violate Facebook's policy, because the White House was asking, what ended up happening? Oh, they ended up reducing the visibility. This was often called visibility filtering over in Twitter's land. Anyway, claims have been debunked by health authorities that would be removed from Facebook. And of course, these health authorities were offering their opinion and without criticism or the opportunity to for other people to criticize those opinions. It really became a one-sided argument on social media. But I want to get to the Tucker Carlson part here. So, yep, here it is. Look at this. On April 14th, 2021, Rob demanded the censorship of Fox News hosts Tucker Carlson and Tommy Lahren because the top post about vaccines that day was, quote, "Tucker Carlson saying vaccines don't work and Tommy Lahren stating she won't take the vaccine." Rob stated, quote, "This is exactly why I want to know what reduction actually looks like. If reduction means pumping our most vaccine hesitant audience with Tucker Carlson saying this does not work, then I'm not sure it's a reduction." In other words, Rob is now aggressively emailing Facebook and Twitter demanding that Tucker Carlson and Tommy Lahren get censored. Yikes. Facebook promised to end up having reports and monitoring on misinformation and disinformation and blah, 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 blah. This nonsense literally just, it continues. We are on page 17 of 155. And we're just getting started. I mean, Rob goes on to suggest that, Facebook responds and says, look, Tucker Carlson's content didn't violate Facebook policy, but Facebook gave the video a 50% demotion for 7 days and stated it would continue to demote the video. Tucker Carlson still gets crazy views, even with a 50% demotion. It's incredible, but it's also, horrible because shouldn't be censorship. And, most people listen to Tucker Carlson, appreciate the different perspective. You know, when he says that aliens are real, I think a lot of us are like, okay, Tucker, okay, all right. Some of it goes a little far, but then again, does he deserve to be censored? No, of course not. So what else do we have here? Rob also suggested regular meetings with YouTube, perhaps bi-weekly, as they have, quote, done with other platform partners. Yikes. Bi-weekly meetings with the White House Disinformation Agency to combat talk on social media. It's just nuts. Tom from the White House apparently also emailed Twitter as recently as November 2021, requesting that Twitter watch a video of the First Lady Jill Biden that has been edited to make it sound like the First Lady were profanely heckling children while reading to them. Twitter responded within 6 minutes, agreeing to escalate it to their team for further review. My goodness. I mean, this is just like a pervasive amount of pressure, if not even coercion. Look at this. On August 11th, Rob emailed Twitter to dispute a note added by Twitter to one of Biden's tweets about gas prices. They're literally complaining about gas prices, trying to massage the actual state of the economy. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that should make you doubt some of the reports we get from the government. Because think about it. If the government is trying to manipulate social media, which they don't control, it does kind of make you scratch your head about, well, what about what they do control? I mean, I don't like to put the tinfoil hat on. I still like to believe that the Bureau of Labor Statistics and some of these other agencies have some level of like freedom and autonomy and desire to actually provide accurate data. But then again, who knows? Who knows? And if anything, over COVID, we've learned you just can't trust everything, especially the MSM. But anyway, look at this. Forgive me, my cough is finally getting a little less bad. It's been like coming up on 2 weeks now at this crap. I can finally sleep through the night without waking up coughing. It's terrible. But anyway, so what do we got here? I got sick in Canada. These Canadians, man, they got some powerful stuff over there. Must be all the smoke in the air. Oh, anyway, look at this. Explicit threats are an obvious... Oh, by the way, before I read this, because it's a very juicy line, if you want to get life insurance in as little as 5 minutes, like what I have, and Apple Pay for it every month, well, it's on auto Apple Pay, check out metkevin.com/life. It's a paid promotion on the channel, as well as how I'm streaming this to you, metkevin.com/StreamYard, where you could use the power of just Google Chrome and StreamYard to put together edited videos, clips, interviews with folks, like Zoom meetings, record them, live stream them, multi-live stream them to Twitch and YouTube and other platforms all at the same time. Some great products. You can see all of these linked down below next to the links for the amazing programs on building your wealth, whether it's real estate investing, stock investing, or just making more money, especially with artificial intelligence, where I give you exactly my rules on making more money using AI, whether you're an employee or an entrepreneur. Check those out, link down below. So look at this juicy piece here. Explicit threats are an obvious form of coercion, but not all coercion needs to be explicit. The following illustrative specific actions by defendants are examples of coercion exercised by the White House. Listen to this, this is intense. Cannot stress the degree to which this needs to be resolved immediately. Please remove this account immediately, demands the White House. How about this one? Accusing Facebook of causing political violence by failing to censor false COVID-19 claims, saying they're hiding the ball or the actual truth about how little they're censoring. I mean, this is like, this isn't even just asking about censoring. It's like aggressively demanding censorship. Quote, internally, we have been considering our options on what to do. In other words, like punishing Facebook for not censoring as much as they wanted, the White House wanted. I care mostly about what actions and changes you're making to ensure you're not making our country's vaccine hesitancy problem worse. This is exactly why I want to know what reduction actually looks like. If reduction means pumping our most vaccine-hesitant audience with Tucker Carlson saying it doesn't work, then I'm not sure it's a reduction. How is Tucker Carlson's video demoted yet still getting 40,000 shares. Yikes. Wanting to know why Alex Berenson had not been kicked off Twitter, because Berenson was the epicenter of disinformation radiating out from, basically regarding vaccines. We want to make sure YouTube has a handle on vaccine hesitancy and is working towards making the problem better. Noted vaccine hesitancy was a concern, and it's shared by the highest, and I mean highest, levels of the White House. So, Hunter Biden? Oh, no, I went there. I didn't mean it. Did I? I don't know. Anyway, there's a ton of this, and it just goes on. Not to sound like a broken record, but how much content is being demoted, and how effective are you at mitigating reach, and how quickly? Listen to this. Rob told Facebook, "Are you guys effing serious? I want an answer about what happened here, and I want it today." Dude, this Rob guy sounds like a straight-up asshole. Anyway, we expect more from our technology companies. We're asking them to operate with transparency and accountability. We're asking them to monitor more carefully. So, Jen Psaki even goes on to say, "We are in regular touch with these social media platforms, and those engagements typically happen through members of our senior staff, but also members of our COVID team. We're flagging problematic posts that spread disinformation." Psaki also stated one of the White House asks of social media companies was to create a robust enforcement strategy. My goodness. I mean, hey folks, wanted to flag the below tweet and wondering if we could get moving on having it removed ASAP. Yikes. Anyway, this continues on and on and on. It's 155 pages of these allegations. But what's really impressive is the finishing of this, the conclusion. Listen to the quote they open with. "Once the government is committed to the principle of silencing the voice of opposition, it only has one place to go, and that is down the path of increasingly repressive measures until the government becomes a source of terror to all its citizens and creates a country where everyone lives in fear." Harry S. Truman. The plaintiffs, arguing against the White House, the Biden administration, the FBI, and otherwise, are likely to succeed in the merits in establishing the government has used its power to silence the opposition. In almost a dystopian scenario, in a role similar to that of George Orwell's Ministry of Truth, that the government has embarked on a, quote, far-reaching and widespread censorship campaign, signed July 4th by the United States District Judge Terry Duty. Wow. That was intense. It does make you scratch your head about how much of that still happening today. Hopefully not on Twitter, but then again, you do have Threads coming out. I'm curious, are you going to sign up for Facebook's Threads when it's released tomorrow? Or are you sticking with Twitter? Or better yet, are you sticking with the good old long-form content where you can actually go deep into perspective on things? Who knows? But let me know in the comments down below. In the meantime, here's CNBC basically talking about what I just talked about.
Look, we know what the advertiser wants. That's the easiest one, Andrew. Advertisers want to reach eyeballs, right? Like the goal of every advertisement.
Well, they had the banner of it. I don't know what they're talking about now.
It's like, that's why you advertise. It may be long-term versus immediate, but your goal is obviously to sell product. I mean, that is why people advertise. And so however you can best target, I mean, obviously, you know, we've talked a lot about AI recently. I mean, you think about the way the algorithms work to help you find the right person at the right time with the right message. That's all been something that all of these companies, whether we're talking Meta, whether we're talking TikTok, that's been something we've been talking about for a long time. You know, if you think back to sort of what does the consumer want? Look, the consumer wants, I think, you know, increasingly, I think the consumer wants to be entertained and they want a good experience. Now, to your point, the problem that you run into with all of these platforms is they start serving you more and more of what you like. I mean, that's the way all of these algorithms are built. Every algorithm is going to have some inherent bias to it. I don't know if there's any, you know, the question is, who sets the rules and who can adjust the rules and right. how much, like, do you want Meta fully in charge of what those algorithms for what you see looks like? Same thing with TikTok. I mean, we could debate this ad nauseum. I think you've heard Mark Zuckerberg testify in front of Congress. He would love some rules of the road and some, you know, some base right. level of regulation. I don't think it's going to happen, though.
Rich, we're showing the stock of Meta Platforms at 285.35 this morning. Do you think the success or failure of whatever you think Threads is going to become is in this stock in any way?
No. I mean, to the extent that, I mean, look, I think Zuckerberg's been pretty open for a long time that Twitter has underperformed its potential. I mean, I think that's pretty obvious. It's why it's now, you know, owned by Elon Musk and not a separate standalone public company. You know, is there the ability to create something? I mean, look, Meta's created a lot of things that have gone nowhere. I mean, you know, let's go back. They've done dating apps. I mean, you think about it, they've done gaming. Like, there's been so many things that Meta has tried. Remember the whole currency, they were cryptocurrency, and they were going to enter into that. Like, there's lots of things they try. Whether or not the stage is set to actually be disruptive and sort of create a new Twitter or effectively an alternative Twitter, it's really hard. I mean, to get the type of global audience that you have on Twitter and to get people to use that, I see that, you know, I know we're 24 hours away from when this new product launches. I'm certainly excited to try it. I've already pre-downloaded it on iOS, but we'll see whether the community is there. Certainly Blue Sky, which has been sort of the open source Twitter that Jack Dorsey started, does not seem to be a vibrant community. The only people I really see active there are tech VCs and tech journalists.
So when you think about,
seems like an entertaining place.
What handicap do you put on what Facebook's doing, and what handicap do you put on what Twitter does eventually?
But what really matters for Meta is one thing. The reason we got excited about this stock, I mean, it seems like it was February, I think, when we went to a buy on Meta. You know, the stock is up, I don't know, probably $150 since then. You know, it's been more than a double because their core business is getting better, Andrew, and that's what's going to matter in terms of what drives this stock. Whether Threads would be a nice incremental positive, but what really matters is the overall improvement, Meta's ability to improve their targeting. And I think they're getting pretty close to where they were pre-IDFA, pre-pandemic. Like, you look at sort of the performance of their advertising that we're hearing from brands. It is getting better. They are seeing improved performance, and there's still no one as good at Meta in terms of targeting ads for direct response advertisers. That's why this stock continues to work, is that it is literally just continuing to improve. And I think investors are excited about that. Snapchat's several quarters behind, and I think you're starting to see investors get more excited about Snapchat, but they are still behind where Meta is by a good amount.
Rich, it's always good to see you, getting your perspective on all of it. Appreciate it very, very much.
Lots of shouting about Meta. Too bad they dump all their money on Reality Labs. Although, I can't argue, the stock's done pretty well. All right. So, what is something bearish we could talk about? We just need to find something bearish to talk about. Oh, I know. How about earnings? Let's talk about potentially the first signs of EPS weakness as macro momentum cools. Actually, that's just a straight-up title from Bank of America Securities here. Let's try to understand what they're complaining about here in essentially this two-page report complaining about earnings per share weakness. Stock 600, 12-month forward EPS level, has reached an all-time high in June, helped by the rebound in global growth. That's forward earnings per share, all-time new high in June. Great. Stock's 12-month forward EPS expectations earlier this month hit an all-time high of €37.5, following a 6% rise from the January low. The key driver in the upward revisions to EPS was a sharp rebound in global growth since May. Where's the weakness then? Because so far, that's pretty good, right? Rebound in global growth since Q4 of 2022. Global PMIs rising by 6 points since December, to a 14-month high of 54 in May. At a sector level, upgrades were largely driven by banks, which have accounted for 40% of the rise since January. Uh-oh, what is this? Yet the latest data points to a renewed rollover in EPS, most likely in response to the weakening euro area macro momentum. After a period of strong upgrades, Stock 600 12-month forward EPS expectations have recently started seeing renewed downgrades, likely due to a weakening in the Eurozone momentum. Euro area PMIs down 4 points since April, so in other words, sort of peaking out in April, and a recent surprise is hitting a three-year low. Now, consensus EPS expectations fading, with 2023 Stock 600 EPS growth falling to a new low of 0%. Boy, it really feels like they're writing a piece here out of both sides of their mouth, because on one hand, it's like, look how great everything is. Oh, but recently things are weakening again. Why would these things be weakening? And maybe is there a chart that can help us show this? Spoiler, yes, there is. We're going to talk about that. We see scope for weakening in earnings outlook to intensify in response to deteriorating global growth. So let's understand this. If we're looking at deteriorating global growth momentum and this potential further weakening, then you could end up seeing more of an earnings recession in Europe. And so I want to see, how does this look chart-wise, and how's their stock market reacting to this? So, and why is this happening? Well, they argue that A, more tightening coming, especially with tighter credit conditions and the lags that we've been expecting. Although we've been talking about lags for like a year and a half now, and it just feels like it's taking forever to actually show up. B, the likely fading of tailwinds that have offset credit-related growth. This would be like your excess savings that basically let you spend through a tighter economic period. And ultimately, a fading of some of that stronger fiscal support that you've gotten in the U.S. and the euro area. So what does this look like chart-wise? Well, here it is. These are the expectations going forward. If we look at EPS growth and sales growth, we get the numbers here. The first one I think that's worth looking at is the 2023 EPS growth and the 2023 sales growth. So those are going to be your blue lines, not your grays. So go over here. You've got EPS growth essentially turning to negative. You could see some of the recovery you had briefly coming out of last year. This was sort of your uptrend in January, February, although we've recently trended right back down. And so this is really representative of flat earnings per share growth. This would be your EPS growth. This would be your sales growth, but with higher costs, you're basically at zero growth in earnings. Now, what's remarkable is, even though these numbers are so low for 2023, 2024 sales growth is just here. But look at the explosion expected in earnings per share growth for next year. So even though we might be flat on EPS for 2023, if you get out of the stock market now because you're worried about 2023 earnings, you're missing what could be 7 to 10% EPS growth next year, which is remarkable. That's really good growth. As a result, what is something like the DAX doing in Germany? Well, even though it's near all-time highs, it's basically just chilling out near all-time highs and trading sideways, which is not bad. I would not mind that at all. If you go back at the max look at the DAX, you can basically see we hit all-time new highs. We're basically at December of 2021 levels for the Germany stock market, and they're worried about a 2023 EPS decline. Like, this is really all the bears can give us. This horribly bearish news is leaving us with the DAX that's up 10% for the last 6 months. Year-to-date up 13%. Year-over-year up 28%. 5 years also up 28%. And then out to the max here. I mean, obviously, you can see you're at all-time highs here. So it's kind of neat, though, to see this, because remember our favorite bear, Mr. Mike Wilson over at Morgan Stanley? What does he always say? He always says, hey, EPS recession coming, buckle up. But wait a minute. If you're going to buckle up for the EPS recession, what that's saying is you're wanting to sell because you're worried about those low 2023 numbers on this chart, which again, to make that very, very clear, are these numbers right here. And because you're so worried about those 2023 numbers, you'd be willing to give up these delicious 2024 numbers there in purple. It's just, That just doesn't make logical sense. But okay, whatever. What do we have over here? This is the forward EPS look. And sure, you can see some recent decline here in the level of EPS. But, you know, what I think people so frequently forget is look at the trend where we previously were. I want to manipulate that line. I'd like to get something like, good notes is being funny. Look at that. I can move the highlighting. I didn't want to move the highlighting. I just want to be able to draw a diagonal line. There we go. Here's probably your trend. Let's try to get a little bit of a trend line on what we had previously. There's your previous trend, this purple line. So you're just now barely breaking through this trend. And quite frankly, if you don't look at trend and you just sort of look at this on a nominal basis, what do you find? Well, you find that you're actually still quite a bit above what you previously had in terms of a level of earnings per share. And I think it's easy to forget that we have grown a lot. We're this whole green box above what we were in 2017, 18, 19, which is fantastic. But yeah, some decline, potentially below trend here, and I expect some volatility. But then again, this is also just a scenario. It's not actually what's happened yet. But what's important about this is, if this is what the market is pricing in, this sort of decline, and what if we end up bouncing at trend here? If the market is pricing in that kind of pain, and the stock market's just laughing it off, hey, that's great. Here's another one, forward EPS versus the global composite. New orders, that's the darker blue line, not that important. Over and undershoots of EPS analysis versus inflation. This just gives you an idea of euro area expected headline CPI. You can actually see it's expected to potentially go negative by 2024, which is great. On a three-month change basis. And then you have the stock 600 forward EPS less the macro hit in the light blue line. All right, not that big of a deal. Some more charts here giving you a little bit of a look. My favorite one here as well on margin projections, just showing you that the markets are basically already assuming that margin growth is going to fall, that sales growth, EPS growth, everything's expected to rotate down. But again, look at what the stock market is actually doing. So I always scratch my head over this. I'm like, man, the bears are so bearish, but the market's already assuming this and it's still doing well. So where's the surprise? I don't know. Who knows? I think that's where the bears are really relying on some form of a black swan. But in terms of actually seeing something right now, it's tough to find. Tough to find something to be bearish with. So anyway, I always like to cover something bearish every day. I'm a big fan of sharing perspectives. That's exactly what I do in the courses on Building Your Wealth link down below. My goal is to wake you up when it comes to investing in stocks or real estate or making more money as an entrepreneur or self-employed, whether it's understanding how attorneys work, CPAs work, realtors work, how the game is played, how to build your wealth. Guarantee you'll find something in there that changes your perspective and helps you build wealth. So check it out. I'll link that down below. And that's my take on the bear piece. Priced in EPS pain that the stock market just right now doesn't seem to care about. Which, again, also makes intuitive sense because are you really going to sit out 2023? Because you're so worried about 2023 that you're potentially willing to be mispositioned going into 2024. Because remember, it's not as easy as like sell now and just get back in January 2024. Usually the stock market starts pre-pricing in good news or bad news ahead of time, which means maybe that EPS downgrade is already priced in, whereas the upside of 2024 is just now being priced in. Who knows? All right, what else are we going to cover? Let's see what are they talking about here?
During COVID, they're not operating that way now economically, and they're clearly not operating that way militarily. So what you're asking me is to make sense of it. It is clear as day to me that Xi Jinping is planning to move militaristically over Taiwan. The Taiwanese know it. We know.
Okay. Tell me why, because this sounds like fear-mongering bullcrap.
What happened with Hitler and his crew. I know that sounds bombastic, but I'm telling you that history is rhyming right now, and unfortunately, I think we're headed to a very dark place.
Where's your research and stats?
We'll end it there.
and I know.
There and plan to speak again in the next couple of weeks. Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, coming up is FOMO.
Oh, that is so priceless. I know that sounds bombastic, but China's ready to invade in Taiwan. Yeah, well, we'll end it there. Dude, it's 5:22 in the morning. There was no reason they had to cut to commercial there. I get it when it's like 5:59 and they got the new hosts coming in. This was a full shutdown. Oh, what a burn. But that it's just ridiculous. Whatever. All right, what do we got? What do we got on? I don't know. Maybe Doomberg can give us something better. Uh-oh. Oh, there it is. I need something juicier than that. That was just trash. Bloomberg surveillance. What are you all surveilling?
People anticipating now the Fed goes again this month.
Right.
Maybe goes again after that. Where are you in the team now?
So Krishna Guha does our Fed work. He has one more and done. And so that's what I would follow. At this point, the one more is baked in the cake. I think anything from now is a mistake. They're just creating a deeper recession or the more likelihood of a recession. At 5.25 with the bond yield at 3.80, they're pretty much done, and inflation slowing. The Fed hiked rates in March of 2022. And at that point, inflation had already gone crazy. And they were still doing the transitory. And then they were still doing QE. And so, and as I can tell, by the time they cut rates, inflation will be so far down, it'll make them look a little wrong-footed again.
Over the years, you've been considered for a Fed president, certainly as a Fed governor, and as well. Ed, what did this Fed get wrong? Was it too much communication? Were we advantaged with the silence of Greenspan?
I think it's very difficult to have 300 PhDs make a forecast. Not buttering you up, Tom, but I'd rather have you make that forecast than 300 PhDs.
Yeah, Mike said I can't do that. Mike walked in one day and said, Tom, I don't need any forecasts on air. Continue.
And so I think it's just part of the stickiness of the decision making.
It's by committee.
And I also tend to try and always go where the puck is going, to put it in your terms. And boy, the evidence that things are slowing on inflation is really pretty awesome.
We're going to have you back, but you hired Gretzky. How's Julian Emanuel doing? To me, like,
you know, that's actually a perfect lead-in to what I just wanted to talk about, which is inflation. In fact, take a look at some of the expectations here on inflation. I'm going to start with Goldman Sachs and literally a piece called, you can't make it up, folks. Goldman Sachs, look at this. The case for declining core inflation. Core inflation stopped falling in the first half of the year, and the FOMC now projects core PCE to end the year at just about double its 2% target. However, we see four reasons to expect renewed declines in inflation this summer and beyond. One, a 9% pullback in used car auction prices that we believe is only halfway done. Two, a negative residual seasonality in the summer for CPI and PCE prices. Now, that's an interesting one to me. I was worried that you were going to have more seasonal spending this summer on travel and hotels and airfares and that. So I guess that one, we'll have to look at some of their details on that one. The sharp deceleration in apartment rent list prices, great, and diminished upward pressure from lease renewals. Okay, this is good. Remember, housing, core housing, makes up somewhere around 35% of CPI and about 25% of PCE. That's a big deal. Okay. And significant progress on labor rebalancing. All right, so let's see here. So the used car prices, we somewhat get this, okay? Auctions have already pulled back 9%, and these declines will begin to flow through in CPI with the June CPI data in 2 weeks. In other words, buckle up, we're gonna start seeing those used car prices start plummeting in our June CPI data, or at least we should. Now this I'm curious about. We find that both CPI and PCE seasonal factors are basically fitting to a sharp rebound in travel and transportation categories in the mid-2020 era following the end of the initial COVID lockdowns. We estimate seasonal headwinds of 10 to 15 bips in the next two CPI reads and five in the next. Okay, that doesn't give me much detail, but really what they're basically saying is they're not too worried about this travel boom, which that's been one of the things that I've been worried about. Now, not worried enough to really trade on it, because I'm like, oh, I might have to be prepared for that. I might have to, you know, sort of diamond hand through it. But Goldman here is actually saying, no, you don't even have to be worried about that. And I'm like, dude, I mean, I thought I was bullish, but like, it sounds like they're going full bull here. Anyway, we continue to expect a further decline in shelter inflation. Rent measures have slowed from a 20% annualized pace of rent growth in mid-21. To just over 1% annualized the last 8 months. This, by the way, if rents go negative, massive catalyst for you to be careful with investing in real estate. You're investing in real estate and you're expecting rent comps to be something like what you've seen even in January of this year. You could be sadly mistaken. So be careful here. Let's see here. Cleveland Fed research and our own analysis reveal that at least half of the post-pandemic premium on new rental units has unwound, which will reduce upward pressure on new signings, okay? Final reason would be the jobs worker gap having halved and sequential growth in hourly earnings up 4%. Normalized commodity prices, that's true. We never saw that like Chinese commodities explosion. And so that's why you're getting their forecast here on CPI. But this is great. This is actually a fantastic piece here on what's going on with CPI. But it's not just this. There are two more pieces I'd like to hit on. Number one, listen to these analysts are actually starting to make me nervous because they're all starting to sound bullish. Listen to this. Deutsche Bank just put out a piece. 5 upside risks. What? Now I'm starting to get more nervous. I like it when they're all bears and I'm the bull. Now they're all sounding bullish. It's making me start scratching my head a little bit going on. Oh, is it sustainable? Anyway, 5 upside risks. Some ways a recession might be avoided. All right. By the way, if you're a big fan of picking stocks and you want a phenomenal way to get a condensed read on fundamental analysis every single day the market is open, make sure you're part of my course member live streams. Pretty much every day the market's open, we do fundamental analysis. I do it for you. People listen back to it in 2x if they want, or they watch it live. And we study companies every single day the market is open together. Get lifetime access. All you have to do is link down below, join one of the courses once, and you're in. So what do we have here? What are the 5 reasons? Deutsche Bank research is still expecting a U.S. recession and very slow growth in Europe, but this piece considers ways in which some potential upside scenarios for growth could play out, with the potential to create a much better outcome than is appreciated now. Number one, the nature of the pandemic shock and massive stimulus makes this cycle different. Oh, no. Oh, no. Their first reason is literally this time is different. Okay? So there's a risk that using past cycles as a comparison might be misleading. We've never seen this quantity of stimulus outside major wars. The stimulus created accommodative financial conditions. And even in the summer of 2021, as inflation began to climb, 30-year mortgage rates were still below 3%. Kind of wild. At the same time, consumers were able to build out large pools of savings that could cushion the economy through current shocks. In other words, a lot of this excess savings still available, mostly amongst the middle to upper incomes, not so much anymore amongst the lower incomes. Here's your PPI, producer price inflation. Look at that plummet on the year-over-year change. It's a beautiful chart. But anyway, what do we have here? There are several signs that inflation could ease over the months ahead. And if inflation did normalize, it would enable central banks to pivot away from restrictive policy. Now, this is true. This is something I've regularly talked about, that the devil in this economy right now is the fear that you're going to get Paul Volcker'd, or at least that's what it was in 2022. That fear has mostly gone away since we've seen inflation start rolling over, as we expected it would. It has taken a lot longer than expected, though. That is, unfortunately, the sad part, is that it's taken a lot longer to get inflation to rotate away, but working out. What do we got here? Inflation has clearly started to fall in recent months. U.S. CPI was running at 4% in May, the lowest level since March of 21, while the euro area CPI was at 6.1, the lowest since Feb 2022. Producer price inflation coming down even faster. U.S. PPI down to just 1.1%. Supply chains have healed. New York Fed's index of global supply chain pressures is at a record low going back to 1997. Labor market is normalizing, with high vacancies falling, and U.S. quits back to normal levels seen before the pandemic. M2 money supply is falling at a rate not seen since the 1930s. This, of course, signals lower inflation. Some people argue that that is going to be your immediate lead-in to a recession, which is also obviously possible. If inflation did fall durably back to target levels, that would in turn permit central banks to pivot in a dovish direction. Agreed? Reason number three, the case could be argued that rate hikes haven't been as damaging as originally feared, despite the most aggressive cycle of hikes since the 1980s. Because fiscal policy, in other words stimulus, has cushioned the impact and consumers still have excess savings, the tightening in real terms is actually less aggressive. So 5% today, 500 bips today, isn't that big of a deal. Number four, consumer confidence has been improving recently. And number five, if commodity prices keep falling, that would continue to create a positive tailwind that consumers have had since the start of 2023, while also helping with inflation, especially with gas prices coming down. This is really incredible. I mean, so now you have Goldman Sachs talking about inflation falling. You've got Deutsche Bank giving five reasons why a recession might be avoided. And there's another Goldman piece we're going to go into in a moment. But basically, I mean, this time is different, I don't think is a great argument. I think people having more excess savings is a good argument. Inflation falling, yes, we know that's happening. Labor market balancing, great. Commodities down, great. People are insulated from these rate hikes and consumer confidence rising. These are fantastic arguments. Now, let's go to the next piece here on what core inflation falling would actually look like. We've already gone through one of these Goldman pieces, but there is a second piece here. Let me see here. That mostly just reiterates some of the information that we've already covered. So this is fantastic. This is actually such fantastic news that Flores here just wrote, "Thank you. I own four of your courses. I highly, highly recommend your courses. A ton of valuable information." Oh, that's really nice of you to say. Thank you for that. Zero Phases here says, "The new risk is deflation." To some extent, that's the Kathy Woodian argument, right? That deflation is a risk. I actually agree with Jerome Powell that you're probably going to have to slowly get to 2%. But yeah, I mean, look, you're not going to see that 2% maybe until late 2024, early 2025, as Powell says. But deflation, I wouldn't really expect within the next couple of years. But is it possible to see deflation over the next decade? Absolutely. In fact, I would probably argue it's more likely to have deflation over the next decade than it is to have inflation over the next decade. We'll see. Most of the bears will make the argument that, well, when that earnings recession comes, the Fed's going to just print money again, and it's going to cause the second wave of inflation. So far, we haven't seen that. We don't have evidence that we're even anywhere remotely close to that. But then again, if you look at the United Kingdom with that increasing core and this idea that as Max pointed out this morning here in the chat, that there are expectations that the Bank of England might have to raise rates to 7% to rein in their core inflation that's skyrocketing. Yeah, I mean, there are definitely problems that could occur. Now, maybe the United Kingdom is different, or the United Kingdom is the canary in the coal mine. So as nice as it is to be bullish, beware. It's possible the United Kingdom is also the canary in the coal mine. So keep an eye on that core inflation in the United States. I do have concerns that core inflation is going to pop off thanks to summer travel spending, but it is possible that is already reflected and priced in. So we'll see. Either way, this is more bullish information from the Wall Street analysts, whom, quite frankly, have been quite negative lately. So not fantastic. But anyway, that gives us some of the bullish talk on inflation and how the economy might play out. Let's listen in to Doomberg.
Move to Florida. You are part of the New York City fabric. Explain how you view the future of this great city.
It's very tough because so many people are moving to Florida, but this city is so vibrant. Just being here with you, which I know you love the city and all the institutions in it.
Never bet against New York. That's the only reason I got this job. I said that to the mayor at the time. He said, you're hired.
But anyway, as long as Mike Bloomberg is here, right. I think we're here.
Okay, what are we going to do with the Fed? One final question. What's the Fed, Ed Hyman, Fed strategy here forward?
So they're going to hike one more and then they're done.
When do they cut?
Probably, you know, I think toward the end of this year, but maybe early next year. But I can look down the street. I can't see around the corner. But when I get to the corner, you'll have a much better idea.
That's the smoke from Canada. That's right. You can't see. Ed Hyman, thank you so much. I know you've got a run here. He is with Evercore ISI and truly iconic on the street. Someone who reads the market economics of Ed Hyman is Michael McKee, and he rejoins us right now here with a brief on the labor economy. John, ADP claims tomorrow. Do I care? Michael, do I care?
Claims you care about because of the big surprise last week when we dropped so many and went back to a previous level. So does it go back up again? And as Ed was just saying, when you're looking to see some sort of weakening of the labor market, you're looking at jobless claims, and we're just not seeing it at this point. The ADP numbers are always traded on, but they don't matter all that much. They even say they're not a data point that's going to forecast the jobs numbers. So, yeah, we'll get some action on that. But we could, in theory, see more action on jobless claims if they went one way or another to a significant extent.
What are wages doing? And, you know, Ellen Zentner mentioned this, and Ed Hyman has a killer chart. We protect the copyright of all our guests. Get that from Evercore ISI or Mike McKee. But Mike, on wages, do you look at wages or inflation-adjusted wages? Where's the best value Friday at 8:30?
Well, you're going to want to look at the hourly earnings, which are not adjusted because, of course, nominal spending, nominal wages are the way you're going to be able to compare those. But it is average hourly earnings that the Fed is looking at to see if we're starting to see some sort of progress on the idea of companies having to pay up for labor. And if that's comes down some more, they will feel better. We have seen inflation fall below wages and earnings, just particularly for the ECI, and that is good for the American public, for people who are getting paychecks, but it doesn't mean that we are seeing a decline in the inflationary pressures. And what we're not seeing, as Ed was just saying, is productivity that would make up for the higher wages. So right now, that's something that has to come down or productivity has to go up.
But what about the technology overlay? Do you believe, you know, and I say this, folks, with immense respect for Mike's encyclopedic knowledge of the data and what it represents. A la Paul Romer, the Nobel laureate on technology, does our present clumsy math of productivity capture what technology is doing to this nation?
There's a lot of debate about that, Tom, and productivity is hard to measure, especially with technology and the way we use it. But the one thing you have to note is that for the last decade or so, most of the technological improvements that we've seen have been in the leisure category. Your phone, the fact that you can carry around all the streaming TV in your pocket kind of thing. What we're waiting for is something that really affects the workplace like computers did in the 1990s. Now, maybe that's going to come with artificial intelligence, and that does seem to be moving forward quickly. We don't know exactly how it will be adopted or how quickly, but if it is anything like the 1990s, we could see a nice run of productivity increases.
I'm into the data here right now, and we're going to come back with Michael McCann, a really important discussion fermenting over the weekend. Futures down 0.5%, down 24. I'll wait to the tape here in the last number of minutes with the VIX, not a 13, the VIX out to 14.48. The S&P percent move, 0.54%. We say good morning, and on radio and television, a really eventful Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. I really want to look forward to Friday and the 8:30 jobs report. We'll go beneath the headline data, but far more. We're just loaded with data for it, including in an hour and 20 minutes, Michael McKee in Washington with a look at our durable economic data. Michael McKee, over the weekend, and this goes to my book of the summer with Olivier Blanchard, is this raging debate of R-starred. Now, we're not doing, it's July, Mike, we're not doing wonky difference equations or that, but I want you to frame the two camps. John Williams just reaffirmed we go back to where we were, some form of lower run rate for the economy codified by the econobabble of R-starred. Others disagree, and they're out at a new R-starred, which is elevated. Who are those two camps?
Well, first, let's define our star. It's basically the neutral level of interest rates, which means they don't stimulate or hold back inflation. And so what you're looking for is the sweet spot, which you cannot identify except in hindsight. But John Williams at the Fed, along with the late Tom Laubach and Catherine Holston, came up with a formula to try to estimate where it is. And during the pandemic, they suspended that because they couldn't get enough accurate numbers. Yeah. And now they've brought it back. And what they say is under their new formula, the way they've accounted for the pandemic, et cetera, it means that this R-star number, the neutral rate, goes back in a relatively short period of time down towards 2% or less, which means less inflation.
We're going to continue.
Yes, less inflation. That's what I heard. Other R-star R not talk. Boring. And here's a TV commercial. Also boring. All right. So what else? Again, Fed Minutes today. Those will be out at 11 a.m. Pacific time, which I will be in Arizona. I don't know how I feel about Arizona today, quite frankly. But I will tell you, I will probably be wearing a T-shirt, really short shorts and flip-flops, because my understanding is it's going to be like 100 and something. Let's see. Weather. Oh, yeah. Going up to potentially 111 today. Fantastic. Why am I going there? I don't know. But if I look at what the weather would be if I just stayed home, the high would be 69. Oh my gosh, that's almost double. Anyway, so all right, what do we got over here on CNBC's?
Yeah, so very well.
Yeah, follow it pretty closely. Our next guest says the retail sales are higher than pre-pandemic levels, but price hikes might finally be catching up with consumers. So joining us now to talk more about the retail sector, Sucharita Kodali. She is the retail analyst at Forrester Research. Sucharita, it's great to have you here. Let's pick up there with Amazon. Obviously, Prime Day is coming here on July 11th and 12th.
Oh my God, Prime Day is coming. How much did CNBC get paid to just pitch Prime Day is coming over and over again?
Where things were a little quieter, and of course, to continue that Amazon flywheel of getting more Prime subscribers signed up. Is that still the goal? I mean, how important really is Prime Day to Amazon? And if I'm invested in Amazon, which has so many verticals, do I care?
It's a huge shopping day for Amazon. Amazon, I would say it actually really came out of the Singles Day promotions that Alibaba and other Chinese merchants did. And it was just essentially a manufactured sale day that if you can get enough offers and promotions, you can generate huge, huge sales. And Amazon actually does. Last year, our estimate was that through the Prime event, it generated about $11 billion, which is huge. I mean, if every day in e-commerce were that big, it would be bigger than all of retail. So it's several times larger than normal. It builds relationships with a lot of its third-party sellers. And absolutely, it generates energy that it uniquely has. I mean, every retailer tries to compete. I think last year we evaluated like 100 merchants and like 70 of them also had Prime Day offers. But nobody really generates the amount of volume that Amazon does during the Prime Day sales events.
In a year like this one, where inflation is still running fairly hot, even if the rate of inflation is coming down, prices themselves are still elevated for consumers. So is a Prime Day in competing retail sales more important? Meaning, could it generate a little bit more heat this time around for other retailers as well, for consumers that are trying to score those deals that they haven't had in a while?
Yeah, I think that definitely Amazon, no question, will do well every year. It issues a press release saying that it's their biggest day of the year ever, usually until the holiday season eclipses it. But it does very, very well, and it works really, really hard to get those very compelling offers. As far as other merchants, I'm not so certain that the other merchants are just really even able to compete. They don't put as much effort into it. They don't source the unique deals that Amazon does. And if you don't source those unique deals, you're not going to get them. And they really focus, other merchants tend to focus more on the holiday season. Like that's when their doorbusters, like their Prime Day sales event is really Black Friday and Cyber Monday. It's not July.
Sucharita, as the student loan relief program ends, who's going to be hurt by that? And I guess maybe on the flip side, when the program went into place, did we see certain income available to consumers?
I wouldn't say it was just because of the student loan deferrals. It was a whole slew of things. I mean, it was everything from the fact that people were saving through the pandemic. It was the stimulus checks. I mean, all of those things combined, higher wages, they were collectively factors that led to consumer spending more in retail. Now, how much is this going to hurt retail? I think that what we are seeing and what we've been seeing over the last few months is a slowdown and essentially, consumers almost feeling saturated with what they are buying or trading into other categories. So we're certainly seeing more spend in sectors like travel, and that's not helping the retail industry at all. So we've been seeing this flatlining. I think that I think watchers may say that, oh, they'll blame the student loan issues. But the truth is that this has been trending for some time. I expect retail to have a tougher overall 2023 than it did in 2022. That's just due to the fact that consumers are spending in far more diverse categories in now than they were in 2021 and 2022.
Interesting take, of course. Yes, this could end up being a bit of an excuse, I guess, for retailers as things may get tougher here in the back half of the year. Sucharita, thank you for joining us.
More excuses. All right. So let's take a look at, Max is pointing out an interesting piece here on debt. I took a look at it, and I will share it. Okay, here we go. Oh, one sec. Oh, let's write that down. Okay. Is it possible there is a big debt bubble? Yes, it is. In fact, there is a debt bubble, especially at a lot of smaller companies, but also at some larger companies. I'll show you a couple larger companies in this video. And I'll show you where to look for which companies might be at a massive interest rate shock potential. We'll look at exactly all of that in just a moment after we look at this Wall Street Journal piece brought to us by course member Max. Course is obviously linked down below. What do we got here? Markets ignore the looming debt peril. Basically, Some companies just have too much debt. But so far, investors aren't actually pricing that in. In fact, you could look at some companies like Carvana, which has just exploded, even as people are ignoring the levels of debt that Carvana has, which basically brought it to near bankruptcy last year, which is why it sold down as much as it did. And so the article in the Wall Street Journal here makes the argument that there are three types of companies and business models that are really going to hit the hardest. And this author basically says the market is dashing towards trash right now, being blind about the potential for these weak borrowers to just get whacked. Number one would be, as they call, your most obvious disaster. Super speculative companies that have financed them their final stages of production and mostly ended up being SPACs, using debt financing to become these zombies that are probably trending towards bankruptcy. Some of these companies, in my opinion, are probably going to be, although you do have the Saudis backing them, your Lucid, your Arrival, your Canoe. Those are some of the EV highly indebted companies that are getting whacked. Rivian has somewhat separated itself from this, and it's certainly doing better than those that I just mentioned, but not doing great either, with the level of terribly massive negative gross margins you have, not to include net margins, is even worse. It's terrible. I mean, you're spending somewhere around $200 for every $100 of revenue you get. It's bad. But anyway, what do we have over here? Decent businesses. So this is your second type of company. Decent businesses with solid cash flow, but a huge amount of debt. These companies potentially face a reckoning as well. I'll give some examples of these in just a moment and show you in investor relations docs how to look for this. Then, of course, you have offices and hotels. Those are likely to get whacked. And the third type of company is one that might not get hit from a debt point of view, but they're going to end up getting hit from more of an EPS point of view. So you've got these three big risks: companies that get hit from higher interest rate risks, companies that have a lot of debt but have cash flows, but they'll see those cash flows evaporate. And then basically the only thing keeping some speculative companies alive, which is debt. So what I like to do is I like to take inspiration from articles like this where they basically talk about wild bets in the stock market being quite risky, and these are some of the red flags you should pay attention to. And I like to go to actual earnings reports. So what I've done is I've pulled up some earnings reports. This is the Walt Disney quarterly report. And one of the things that I noticed with Disney is that even though you have a net income here of $1.5 billion, you have nearly just a little bit above one-fifth of their net income here getting spent on interest, $322 million in one quarter going to debt. That's over $1.3-ish billion of debt a year that Disney is spending. So in other words, an entire almost quarter of Disney's net income is going to debt in a year. It's pretty wild. It's a lot of money going to debt. And a lot of folks are pointing that out over at Disney and saying, well, maybe that's why Disney is performing more weakly lately in the stock market. Of course, you could look at the balance sheet as well. Jump over to the balance sheet. You could see you've got long-term liabilities here of $13 billion, deferred taxes of $8 billion, putting you at about $21 billion combined. On top of that $21 billion, you've got here short-term bills payable of around $22 billion. Right here, not considering the deferred revenue. So, in other words, you got somewhere around $40 billion of debt at Disney with cash sitting around $10 billion. Now, you do have receivables of another $12 billion, but still, that's an extra $18 billion of debt. What's another one? How about Carnival Cruise Lines? Look at Carnival. Carnival Cruise Lines reporting, and they've done very well here since their last earnings over the last week and a half here. But I think this is what's inspiring this Wall Street Journal article saying, hey, You know, people are turning a blind eye to how much debt some of these companies have, and it's a mistake. But look, for example, at Carnival Cruise Lines. You've got interest income of $69 million, but interest expenses of $542 million. You have losses at Carnival of $407 million. In other words, their interest expense alone is driving them into net income. If they had no debt, they'd be barely break even. But look at the actual number of borrowings they have. They got about $4.4 billion cash. You've got short-term borrowings here, or short-term bills to pay of, what is that, 2.7 plus another 2, call it 4.7. You got about $4.7 billion in bills. But unfortunately, you've got $32 billion in long-term debts. Yikes, $32 billion. No wonder their interest rate is so high, or their interest expense, rather, is so high. Now, one of the things that you can do as well, if you go a little bit deeper into these companies, is you can actually start looking when these notes are all due and payable, which is kind of an interesting strategy for trying to evaluate when these companies might have to raise money in the stock market or issue new bonds. For example, you could jump over here. This is just a few pages down from where we just were in the Carnival Cruise Lines set here. And you can see here's about $2.4 billion at Carnival Cruise Lines due in 2028 at 4%. But then you've got about a billion here at 10% interest. Look at this, some more notes here. A billion at 10.5, $2 billion at 6%, $1.1 at 5.8. And you can see the due dates here with less due here in 2023, but you're starting to get some of these due in 2024. That's where you're really going to start getting a little bit more of your maturities coming through. Although Carnival has really been able to kick the can down the road to mostly what looks like 2026 and 2027, where you're really going to get somewhere around $10 billion coming due by 2027. So while you might have a nice run for the next year or two, at some point the market's going to start pricing in some of the pain coming from debt. And this is a warning and a red flag to start paying attention to. So if you're investing in companies, you really ought to look at companies that potentially have really low debt. Now, I'm not saying go for like super high growth names or SaaS companies, but if you want to see a company that has like a phenomenal balance sheet, like you want to see what a phenomenal balance sheet looks like, do the following. We'll do it together. Go to sec.gov and let's go to filings. Let's search for a company. What ticker are we going to put in? Palantir, P-L-T-R. You ready for this? Okay, hold on. Palantir. Give me my Palantir filings here. I need Palantir filings. Yep, there we go. Better. Okay. Quarterly report. Let's get the last May 9th quarterly report on Palantir. Let's go to HTML here. There we go. Let's look at the balance sheet for Palantir. So, what do we have here? Well, these numbers are in thousands. So, from March 31st, you have $1.2 billion in cash, another $1.6 billion in marketable securities. That puts you at somewhere around $2.8 billion in cash. Call it $2.9 in cash. You have bills sitting on the table of about $178 million. So in other words, let's make this clear. We'll write it down. You know what? We'll put a little notepad over here, and we'll go $2.9 billion in cash. And then you have bills of what? We'll call it 180 mil in bills. Well, if you want to put this in a billion, just put a period in front of it. And then going back to the balance sheet, customer deposits, deferred revenue. I generally don't look at his debts because you're likely to fulfill unless your business goes BK. You've got some lease liabilities here of another $200 million, but no long-term debt. Literally no long-term debt. So that's it. Other than your bills, which is coming from your operating cash flows anyway, you have a company with $2.9 billion of cash and $180 million of bills. In other words, fantastic balance sheet. So that's just a quick lesson for you that it's really easy. It doesn't take a long time to do a quick fundamental analysis like I teach in the courses on building your wealth link down below. It doesn't take a lot of time to do a quick, you know, financial health checkup on the companies you're investing in and go, am I investing in a debt time bomb? And these are important things to consider for your investments, in my opinion, And, of course, reiterating what the Wall Street Journal has just explored here. Anyway, so what else do we have? Well, that does that on debt. Okay, what else do we have? Next, let's listen into, what is that, Kramer's Icelandic Journey?
You,
what?
You come back, ooh, yeah, they were like looking for shipwrecks. These are some good ones. And I came back and I thought one thing, which is that who the heck cares what went up? Stocks went up. And that if you were just possessed by the Fed, you were a gas bag. And you just simply could not make any money. If you were possessed by how China was coming back, you missed everything. If you thought about AI and if you thought about U.S. dominance and what is dominating, you made a killing. And I think we have to get away from those who don't look at stocks and don't look at AI. I mean, for instance, a ChatGPT that did, it took over in November and was a major reason why we had an incredible number of calls that went up. And if we got to get more realistic about what's happening in the economy, which is that the inverted yield curve was possessed by people who turned out to be ill-advised and of no value.
Yes.
And, you know, you say that, and they keep saying, well, then don't worry, we will be correct. But you know what? They lost. The game over. The game ended.
Does the game end?
Game ended. I mean, you either made money in the first half or you went home. I mean, you know, it was like a doubleheader, and they were shut out twice, the first quarter and the second quarter. But they refused to admit it. And their arrogance in refusing to admit it is surprising and suboptimal. Mm.
You sound kind of like...
Jim Cramer is angry. Whatever. I'm going to hop on over to the course member live stream and make myself another cup of coffee first. Thank you so very much for enjoying another Meet Kevin report. Well, hopefully you enjoyed it. I'm going to assume you enjoyed it. I will enjoy the hot swelteringness of Arizona today as we go continue to explore real estate and understand the markets that we're heading into potentially. And we will see you all in the next Meet Kevin report. Thank you so much for watching. Good luck on the minutes. Expect the market to be soft going into the minutes. And hopefully we get some clarity afterwards. Anyway, see y'all soon. Thanks again. Goodbye.